Well, I can remember where I was when they announced the death of Elvis Presley. I was suddenly surrounded by hundreds of Elvis Presleys, all emerging from the metro stations of Paris and seemingly spontaneously converging on a number of key squares in the city in a ritual of acknowledgement of their meaningful memories of Elvis, which in turn has given me a very happy memory, if a slightly surrealist one, of being in Paris. I also incidentally remember where I was when JFK nearly managed to blow us all up, but I'll move on from that. Echoing Susan's key assertion, 20th century French ideas, letters, and society are massively preoccupied and influenced by issues of memory, of memorialization, of what, at the most general level, we might think of as just unhappy consciousness. And Susan's quite right in that memory seems to have replaced the idea and insight of the unconscious, but much of France's self-presentations during the 20th century could be thought of also in terms of the unconscious, or if you will, remembering, repeating, and working through. And that, of course, is the title of an essay written by Sigmund Freud in 1914, and therefore itself produced in the context of what was going to be a European trauma, the First World War, something that was going to shake France's foundations and hasten fundamental social and political change, and thereafter, in its turn, become absolutely memorialized and indeed fetishized publicly. It's a very interesting essay, by the way, for the way in which Freud, for the first time, moves beyond the idea of memory just being enacted to memory in turn generating actions. So it was quite prescient from that point of view. In other words, memory is a whole set of behavioral issues as well. It doesn't just involve behavior. It doesn't just involve content. It involves behavior and perhaps future behavior. And in Freud's words in that essay, we have to give a compulsion that's trying to hide a repressed memory the right to assert itself, which perhaps suggests a sense of time also associated with the recognition of memory that I may return to. France's notion of memory in the 20th century socially is, of course, massively overdetermined by the two world wars, not just the first. Both of them, of course, were fought on French soil, in contrast to a British public and private memory of the same events. But they involved fundamentally different scenarios and situations. If you wander through French villages, as I've been known to do from time to time, you'll find in almost every one of them a monument of some sort to the casualties of the First World War. Mort pour la France, they died for France. But you won't find any similar memorial to the Second World War, though there may be the odd discreet plaque about resistant fighters. Because the context of occupation and the Vichy collaboration, in addition to the official memory of resistance, makes the Second World War something that's remembered and memorialized via very different forms of ritual and remembrance. The most crucial difference between the two, arguably, is that whereas the First World War can be recalled as an example of national heroism, the activities, as Andrew mentioned right at the beginning of his talk, of the Holocaust are sure permitted and even encouraged by elements of the Vichy government in France, represent, therefore, a shameful and guilty memory in French history, as well as, of course, in the collapse of European Enlightenment. And this is a set of activities and a period that until relatively recently, therefore, France almost insisted on remembering only in a public and in certain ways. But this is Holocaust Memorial Week, and so a lover of France needs to insist on the manner in which France, after the war, built and preserved an official memory of this period. To give you one very simple telling example, a senior civil servant in the Gironde called Maurice Papin, guilty of the deportation of thousands of Jews to their murder during the war, including hundreds of children the Nazis hadn't even asked for, was decorated after the war with the Légion d'honneur by General de Gaulle, was budget minister under Giscard d'Estaing, and was repeatedly protected by François Mitterrand until finally, as a result of a satirical newspaper insisting, brought to trial for crimes against humanity not all that long before his death. I hope this doesn't sound remotely like any kind of moral superiority here, because all nations naturally engage in the construction of memory in this way. Britain can be no less charmingly vague when it suits it. All nations construct themselves from a legacy of memories, which they guard and nurture and attempt to influence over time. And a 19th century French thinker called Renan pointed out how individuals become a nation precisely when they consciously have many things in common and equally have purposefully forgotten many things. Both these aspects come together to form part of what he termed a large-scale solidarity. And in all those cases, we eventually construct for ourselves what the French like to call les lieux de mémoire, or sites, realms of memory, exactly like the nodal events Andrew mentions, and completely like the significant locations, such as cemeteries, mentioned by Susan. Indeed, these symbolized heritages of community can be cenotaphs, cemeteries, churches, but can more generally be all our archives, our museums, our acts, our inherited rituals, even our Elvis Presleys emerging from the metro. And according to the French scholar Pierre Nora, who coined the term realm of memory, site of memory, and then unfortunately in a typical French gesture devoted seven volumes to explaining what he meant, these sites of memory are a fairly recent phenomenon. Not all would agree with him. Some would say, isn't Stonehenge a site of memory? But he sees these as being typically modern, and he naturally, in a French context, sees something like the ghost of a French Revolution floating over all subsequent constructions of a French identity, the construction of a national memory. And indeed, this can also explain the complex recollection of the years of occupation during the Second World War in France. But what I like about Nora as a one-time reader of literature is that he also regards literature as being exactly that, a site of memory. I guess in British context, we might think of a Shakespeare or a Dickens as being of this kind. In the French context, he not unsurprisingly mentions Proust's massive A la recherche du temps perdu, In Search of Lost Time, surely one of the architects of memory that hangs over all literature of the 20th century. And the view of memory elaborated in that work reminds us indeed in certain respects of Freud's insights, no more so than in the contrast it establishes between a merely instrumental voluntary memory, where we're struggling to remember but where you only get out what you put in. I think they call it garbage in, garbage out over in the business school, versus the revelatory and transformative effects of involuntary memory. And this, if you like, is the memory that is given belatedly the right to assert itself, and which in Proust we see emerge fully formed or preserved in spite of conscious efforts, indeed, to repress it. Some of Proust's ideas, by the way, resemble the view of memory that was being given, or had been given, by French philosopher Henri Bergson, to whom he was vaguely related. And Bergson, as early as 1896, published a very interesting book called Matière et Mémoire, Matter and Memory, in which he contrasts automatic memory, a bit like changing the gear stick on the car when we all try to get home later, merely utilitarian, something you know off by heart, with true or pure memory, which is, therefore, none of that. Well, he thought of as being free and actually fundamentally spiritual. And you can hear how, well, apart from the fact that's a philosophical restatement of the mind-body dualism, where is the spirit as opposed to the body, which he puts into a sort of temporal realm, you can hear how he's illustrating how consciousness involves being truly aware in the light of the past. It was also a very useful study of pathological cases, even in that early text. Now, Proust's famous example of our memory, as you'll know, and unfortunately we haven't supplied you with these, if I thought about it well enough in advance, I'd have tried to do so, is the Madeleine, which he recounts dunking into the tea and sipping. And at once he says he's pitched into an abyss of uncertainty, which is only resolved when the memory suddenly reveals itself, and reveals itself to be a vast structure. But in the same scene, what the Proust narrator adds is something that can become determining for memory. In other words, memories determine the future as well as just being something that the present expends more time vaguely attempting to recall from the past. Because he tries to understand what the revelation has opened up for him, and he says, and he could be very concise with his words, believe it or not, he says, chercher, pas seulement, créer, seeking, not just, creating. So the point about memory for him, involuntary memory, true memory, free memory, something released by sensation, is that it's not just a moment of voluptuousness, the Madeleine in the teacup. It's not a momentary pleasure. It's in reality the beginning of a lifelong task, whose results we realize we're actually in the process of reading. And from that point, we also recognize that the recherche, which was about trying to remember, also means research, because we're remembering for a reason. And that book, from a French perspective, of course, set the terms for all subsequent writing, really, in the 20th century. Andrew said that I may say something about post-memory. I'll say something very brief about it before I perhaps give one example of a growing post-memory genre. So far, we have a sense of memory as involving, on a personal and political level, a delayed sense then of a project, which is of coming to consciousness of what you are. And in the context of the Holocaust, which I'd mentioned earlier, this delayed effect, delayed because of trauma, delayed because of official repression, continues to resonate now, perhaps only now, quite powerfully in France, and has given rise in part to this label post-memory, coined, I believe, by an American critic called Marianne Hirsch. It denotes at the simplest level the narratives of a second generation of trauma survivors, the way in which the original survivors managed somehow to transmit the inarticulated memory to the next generation, whose task it now is to face up to the responsibility. And given the political sensitivities and the logics of remembering and repeating and working through, I guess we can understand how transgenerational memory, as well as transdisciplinary memory, can get produced. And by way of illustration, I can conclude just by mentioning one rather interesting text that I've looked at in my work recently. A 2004 book called, unsurprisingly, A Secret, by a French psychoanalyst, born in 1948, the date meaning after the war. He's called Philippe Grimbert. He will be talking in London next week or in a couple of weeks' time as part of the Jewish Book Week. And the book usefully pulls together several of the strands that we've mentioned: pseudo-autobiographical recollection, Holocaust testimony, psychoanalytic explanation. It was made into a really rather poor film of the same title. So the book, A Secret, seems at first reading almost programmatically organized around memory recognition. It's an almost classic tale. Again, in the Proustian mold, you have the sensitive and puny only child, you know he's intelligent but he's not going to win at football, who invents an ideally contrasted fantasy brother for himself, and he imagines the wartime past of his superbly athletic parents. But he gradually uncovers, needless to say, a family secret being kept from him, namely that the family is Jewish, that his father had been previously married to his present wife's sister-in-law, that father and first wife had indeed had a son, that this boy and the first wife had been captured at a demarcation point, deported to a death camp, and that most dreadfully, the mother had perhaps somehow willed this in a suicidal and infanticidal act, given an intuitive recognition of the as yet unconsummated desire between her husband and her sister-in-law. I did warn you this was a French tale, and they do like to keep it in the family. But beyond the level of personal recovery of the repressed, the intimate, almost incestuous nature of the betrayal there and the guilt is, in the context of a French nation, obviously additionally meant to be a metaphor of an entire nation's guilty family secret regarding the circumstances of occupation and Shoah. And thereafter, the book seems to offer an almost schematic resolution. As the son discovers all this, interrogates the borrowed or inherited memories, if you will, articulates the past, restores the names and fates, and resolves to be an analyst so he can help others get over the same. Again, very French. But what interests me about the text, I would say in conclusion, rather than the film, is the way in which, as a text, you observe that its structure simultaneously retains a secret or a repressed memory. And it does this through what we would term chiasmus, which is very simply where, say, the first chapter, in a spooky way, uncanny manner, echoes the final. The second last chapter, oh, lo and behold, seems to be a kind of inverted version of the second, etc. And so a structure is created of a circle inside a circle or a box inside a box. Suddenly the progressive story, the progressive heuristics of resolving your trauma are silently revealed by the text itself to be not so easily resolvable as all of that. Indeed, the analyst that Rimbert is might note that this shape contradicts the resolute structure of a cure. And the idea can bring us finally to a realization that the work isn't just the resurrection of the murdered, it's also, more problematically, also their entombment. And that the form memory takes both helps us to acknowledge a repressed memory while looking obscurely to bury it definitively. So perhaps we also recover memories in order finally to put them to rest. That shows that in every secret exposed, there's perhaps another secret being hidden. A secret admitted is also a moment of secretion. That sounds a desperately French thing to say. So perhaps I should stop at that point by being able to say to Barthes, pomme table centime.